This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
The Chicago Teachers Union, CTU, has a tentative agreement. Some have proclaimed the strike as the biggest and most inspiring union victory since the 1997 UPS Teamsters strike. While it clearly demonstrates the resilience of unions and the viability of the traditional strike tactic, it also raises the limitations of what even the best-led unions can accomplish through collective bargaining alone today.
What are the lessons of the CTU strike for the New York City's public school personnel and its students, and for teachers' unions and public workers across the country facing challenges to their very existence? We're joined by Kimberly Bothke, Chicago Teachers Union rank-and-file activist and a CTU House delegate and a member of CORE, the Council of Rank and File Educators, and Brian Jones, former New York City public elementary school teacher, now pursuing a doctorate in urban education, co-narrator of the film The Inconvenient Truth Behind Waiting for Superman, and contributor to the book Education and Capitalism, Struggles for Learning and Liberation. Well, congratulations. That's the first thing.
Double congratulations for me also.
But we want to find out what actually are some of the specific details that you think are productive and should result in an upvote of the contract, Kimberly.
Thank you for having me on, first of all. I really think that because this agreement was crafted by the rank-and-file members of the CTU, it should be taken seriously by its members and then by the community and by the board itself. We tried to win an awful lot of job protections and change the contract so that it will not only help protect workers, but it protects when students are in trouble, the worker can speak out. So, for example, one of our articles has attacked the idea of just being able to be fired for someone not liking you or for you not fitting the requirements of a checklist or of what is called local criteria, which means that the principal can basically pick a few things that he or she wants to focus on. And if you're someone that's a gadfly or the principal really doesn't care for you, those local criteria can be very arbitrary and change, resulting in a bad evaluation and your subsequent firing. So we've got stronger language in there. Now employees can only be disciplined for just cause. And the Board of Education has to provide our union with documents if there is a grievance filed. And also, no more arbitrary disciplining suspensions. There must be progressive discipline used so that the employee has a fair shot to remediate herself or himself if something's wrong. We think that that's a huge accomplishment, especially for labor relations, and something very needed for teachers and educational personnel. So that's a really huge win. Other things that we won, can you believe that our clinicians get locked cabinets? Now they get locked cabinets. They get a bathroom break if it's guaranteed. They get paper clips. Those things are silly, maybe, to some people, but to others, it's a real big deal. The fact is that we don't have that many clinicians for almost 440,000 students. We're woefully under the recommended amount. So we have anywhere between 300 and 325 nurses in our school system of all these children. So we actually won some things. We won a full-time school counselor for every school. That in a system that doesn't use its clinicians very effectively. I mean, there have been years where our agreements have covered part-time or half-time staff, or even 0.2 positions, so that a clinician, a nurse, a counselor would have to visit several schools. That's an ineffective use of labor, and it doesn't help the children. Our children are very distressed. Some schools have the resources, and others don't, including human resources. So we think that this contract gives us a win in those areas. There are other areas that we can discuss, like I think that we've eaten back a little bit on teacher evaluation. Teacher evaluation talks had been going on since October with a team of people from the CTU. I was on that team. And then a team from the Board of Education that would then talk to the executive committee of the Board of Education, some of the bigwigs. And Illinois law only allows Chicago teachers, when talking about teacher evaluation, to consent, to advise. But the final decisions about teacher evaluation rested with the board. And so since the power was with the board, we were constantly arguing, trying to push them towards initiatives that weren't punitive for teachers, but at the same time could help tell us something about our children. And the board pushed back by pushing value-added measuring, which is a calculation that nobody quite understands, but it, in short, places value or places some sort of worth on a person's position and how much experience a person has. We could never get the algorithm from Chicago Public Schools on that, and it's very unfair to judge teachers or anyone by someone else's score or by some of the other things that go into a person having a score, like if they're hungry or what, you know, resources they've had or if they live in a poverty-stricken neighborhood. So we push back on those, and we think that we got in this contract a better position from which to now negotiate, because part of our contract says that we're going to have ongoing negotiations about teacher evaluation and tweak the system. So, for example, Illinois law, the PERA law, the Performance Evaluation Review Act of 2010, said that Chicago or districts that had 500,000 or more children would implement 300 schools in the first year. And the Board of Education in October wanted to implement them right away, all of these changes, including the test scores.
Kimberly, we're going to go on with some of the other gains later on in the program, but I wanted to bring Brian in at this point also to talk, because this strike and the victories here not only impact on Chicago, but resonate with workers and teachers throughout the nation. So, Brian, what do you see from the New York perspective and perhaps a national perspective as the significance of this pushback by the Chicago teachers?
It's tremendously significant. I could listen to Kimberly talk about that all night, but thanks for having me. I just want to issue one quick correction, which is that technically, I'm still a teacher. I'm only on a leave of temporary leave of absence.
Better yet.
Yeah. But I do want to say that I think the Chicago Teachers Union strike, in addition to the material gains that Kimberly just registered for us and was ticking off, is a tremendous moral victory in the mere fact of raising the enormous social question hanging over education, which is, why is it that people like Rahm Emanuel, classic members of the 1%, refuse to give our children the same kind of education they insist on for their own children? They have tried to get out of answering that question by hanging everything about the performance of a school on the teachers. And then they expose themselves in certain ways. You know, the CTU made much hay of the conditions of the school in which Rahm Emanuel sends his own children. We could make the same argument about the school where Bloomberg sent his daughters. You know, they have three of everything, three libraries, three swimming pools, three science labs, and we have plenty of schools here with no science labs, with no libraries. Rahm Emanuel just had a commercial celebrating the new contract from his perspective about why it was going to make the schools better and why he was right all along. And ironically, in his ad, he has kids, you know, in the background over his narration doing art, except 40% of CPS schools have no full-time art teacher. He has kids in very small class sizes working with a teacher, except Chicago schools have some of the largest class sizes in the country. So fundamental questions of who gets what, of why we have what the CTU rightly called apartheid schooling in Chicago, were raised. And I think now the gauntlet is thrown down to those of us who've been fighting to defend and improve public education to make that same kind of case about our own schools here. Why do we have these mushrooming class sizes? And while people like Bloomberg send their kids to elite private schools with tiny class sizes, why do they think that small class sizes are so good for their children, yet not important for ours? And we think it's fundamentally a question of resources, of fairness, and the whole thing of hanging everything on the performance, the value added, so to speak, of the teacher is really about scapegoating teachers for the social crisis. making teachers a kind of social scapegoat where everyone can direct their anger as a kind of misdirection so that nobody sees that we're dealing with austerity schools that have made year after year of budget cuts, oftentimes many budget cuts within the school year.
I've been aching to ask both you, Kimberly, and Brian. I went to a discussion at the Schomburg Center in Harlem and came out of there most dismayed. The audience was overwhelmingly African-American, and there was Stephen Carter, an attorney who has written a number of mystery books, and the latest being a novel on what would happen if Lincoln had been impeached, essentially. In any event, he's a Yale law professor. And there was Pat Battle, an anchor in New York, an African-American woman, started somehow the discussion by saying, or led into one part of the discussion by suggesting that her child was extremely bright, and as a result of being bright in a neighborhood public school, he was thus bullied because it's uncool to be bright in a neighborhood school. And so for his very bodily protection, she had to wrest him away from the terrors of the public school system and put him in a private school. From there, Stephen Carter talked about how he, as a Yale law professor, had a project where he was raising money in New Haven to wrest children away from their beleaguered communities, which were inherently Black and Latino communities, generally poorer economically, and which had nothing else to offer other than poverty and the indicia of poverty in neighborhoods, and again, put them in the private school. And this was the answer, and I was just, it got a good deal of applause, and I was just in such pain and such horror at what almost seemed to be a discussion of the talented 10th, and that the only way of saving a child and educating a child was to take them out of community. And what this meant for the denigration of the public schools was complete and total. I am just interested, because all of this goes to, for both of you really, the issue of public education. And I would like to know whether it's within the context of the CTU strike, which was a strike for personnel and a strike for students and better public school education. And Brian, yourself, what do we learn from this, or what are we supposed to be educating the broader public on who has such inherent contempt for public education?
And Kimberly, before you answer that also, do the parents in Chicago have this contempt also?
Well, I'd like to hear what Brian Jones has to say. They don't come up behind him.
Well, look, it's a mixed picture because, of course, African-American communities across the country have been historically underserved, maligned by public schools often. And in the absence of a vigorous struggle that puts those demands, the needs of groups that have been specifically oppressed by this system, in the absence of a vigorous mass struggle to change those circumstances, I understand why parents want to strike out on their own and hit the lottery and do whatever they can do. I mean, I get that, and I don't begrudge any individual parent that effort. Of course, I understand that. I think that I've also seen the other thing. I saw that, you know, of course, the schools that are always targeted for closure are schools predominantly lower-income, Black and Latino families are sending their kids. And there was a vigorous struggle, a whole series of vigorous struggles last year to stop those closures. One of the most brilliant community-wide struggles where you couldn't see that contempt. In fact, you'd see something quite the opposite. Community pride in their neighborhood public school was the struggle to save Wadley in Harlem. And that was a struggle that was successful. Now, Hollywood isn't going to make a movie about that struggle, because those were public school parents standing with the union against the privatizers. So that's probably not going to get, you know, Hollywood funding. But it happened. It's real. It's a part of what's going on out there. And I think that in Chicago, I imagine, although I'm sure Kimberly knows better, that because of the way the CTU explicitly made a case about racial injustice, and specifically before the strike, fought with parents to try to save community libraries, to try to stop school closures, the parents are taking a different attitude and have an idea that instead of just escaping, there might be some hope of changing the schools. And as long as the union and community activists and people are speaking out in favor of that project and then lending their bodies in a real and material way to that effort in a vigorous way, then, you know, it seems to me like people are, can get inspired by that possibility, not just escape.
Kimberly.
I think that the Chicago Teachers Union and the Caucus of Rank and File Educators specifically, we have waged a battle against school closures since probably 2008. And when Renaissance 2010 came in, which was a program by ex-Mayor Daley to close some of the schools that he felt were underperforming and replace them with these charters, it kind of got the movement really going. You saw a lot of community activists join with the CTU and CORE in trying to struggle against this. Last year, we waged that struggle, and the Chicago Board of Ed decided that it would close or turn around, as they call it, 17 schools. So we did not win that effort. There's this idea that if something is public, it can't possibly be as good as if it were elitist or private. So charter schools in Chicago carry an air of exclusivity, so that if you go there, charter schools are sold as being the option for parents and students if you want smaller class sizes. In fact, a statement was made by someone of a charter school organization that they were the answer to collective bargaining or against collective bargaining, so that the students were freed from the constraints that the teachers' unions would put on collective bargaining. And that's simply not so. The idea of that talented 10th deserving or meriting some sort of special treatment leaves a whole lot of people out in the dust. That's students and teachers. So we've tried to bring in this context of neoliberalism and the economy kind of pushing this argument out that charter schools are going to eventually be public schools and replace a traditional public school. So that's been part of our fight, and we're doing that now as well as in November. The Board of Ed will probably make a list of anywhere between 80 and 100, 120 school closings or schools slated for closure. So I get everyone's concern, and it really does bother all of us.
Kimberly, if you could go a little bit more into the ties of the CTU, the Chicago Teachers Union, and community groups, I think it would be helpful to understand what's been going on there.
The organizing that happened that brought you all together.
You know, we've had some amazing rank-and-file organizers, and we've been organizing not just delegates, not just people from the executive board, but the Chicago Teachers Union has an organizing department that's been doing a lot of outreach to teachers in the pulpit, where we take training and we join up with churches, or we ask temples to allow us 5 minutes to speak in their bima about education issues or critical public school issues. So we've reached out to those communities, the religious communities. We've also done a lot of one-on-one talking, leafleting at L stops, flyering neighborhoods, with the intention not of just leaving a flyer and letting it passively sit, but getting to someone, talking to someone about issues. Because oftentimes, the public doesn't really know. They only know from their own experience, which may be 20 years old, or, you know, way back when the system was slightly executed in a different way. There have been other groups that have gotten with us, a Southside group of rather well-off parents who like their public schools and don't want others to suffer any kind of bad faith, the 19th Ward parents. They've done amazing work of placarding and flyering and being on corners throughout for months throughout this year. There's Parents for Teachers, which is on the north side that invites everyone, and they've been at every rally. They've had their own rallies. They've had their own walks, protests. And so the CTU has a lot of outreach in the community, and it's not just about teachers' concerns. It centers around the economics, it centers around the students, and it centers around the community and keeping communities solvent in a time of austerity. Does that help?
Yeah, it helps a lot. And Brian, I'm interested in how you pick up from this or where a group like MORE, which is a coalition of groupings within the public schools, teachers in New York, have come together. and what they can learn from or employ, and what you think the issues are similarly that are impacting and will create major issues for our public school teachers and children?
Well, we have, very similar to Chicago, we have a neoliberal program of privatization, school closure, you know, bringing in high-stakes standardized tests, an incredible battery of very expensive tests, a testing regime. They're developing music tests and art tests and testing kids at an earlier age. I mean, it's just, it's completely similar to what's happening in Chicago.
John Coltrane wouldn't have done well with those music tests.
Exactly.
I love it, you know, music and art tests, yes.
I mean, right, make kids hate music at an early age. I mean, it's just
definitely
ridiculous. So there's a new caucus, as you mentioned. It began as a coalition, and now it's its own organization. I mean, individuals can join, and it's a union caucus within the UFT called the Movement of Rank and File Educators. So it's more directly, I mean, we're not trying to make any secret of the fact that we're modeling ourselves on CORE in Chicago. Our slogan is that our working conditions are our students' learning conditions. And we're trying to take the lesson from Chicago that we have to put a premium on speaking with the same voice as the parents and the students in the school. So we're trying to take up issues like the testing regime, questions of the curriculum, questions of racial and economic injustice in which schools are getting which treatment, which closure, which punishments, which schools are getting rewards. Also, even deeper issues that have to do with the institutional racism of the criminal justice system and the way it's now seeping into school and messing up the education process by giving kids summonses for minor infractions and criminalizing youth inside the school. So there's all these kinds of issues that cry out to be taken up, and we think our union will be better if it is set up to do that. And that's what we're trying to do, is change the UFT in a way that will allow us to press forward the kinds of struggles that we're going to need to defend our schools and to improve them, to make them the kind of schools that we all want them to be.
We also have a Chicago Teacher Solidarity kind of campaign, and that was a group of people from various communities in Chicago who saw what was going on, wanted to make their own thing, wanted to help the teachers. And when we say teachers, we mean all of the people who are represented by the CTU. And so they made their own thing. They went out in the community and canvassed. They made shirts. They had forums. And also, in addition to the outreach, we had people reaching back. So we had support from all over this nation and all over the planet.
And do you think that part of what also drew the parents and students into support for the CTU, since certainly in New York there have been many historical rifts which have been based on racial issues, among other things, were some of the issues that were raised by the CTU around the plant facilities?
Absolutely. I mean, we have those very same problems, questions of air conditioning, questions of overcrowding. Especially now, the places where we've been dealing with charter school co-locations, often public school children, even elementary school children, have been pushed into boiler rooms, into closets, conducting class in situations that are not safe or appropriate for class. Now there's just been a new thing out that there's chemicals in the schools that activists have been warning about for years, not in all schools, but in some schools, that are at higher levels than, you know, we were told by the DOE, and so we're having to press forward questions around that. There's definitely questions of inequality and injustice in facilities, repair, infrastructure that have to be addressed.
And, Brian, is there a way to contact More in New York?
Yeah, morecaucusnyc.org, M-O-R-E, caucusnyc.org. And just sign up there on the mailing list, and you'll get all the information.
And, Kimberly, we're going to give you the last word. Michelle Rhee was all over NPR, all over in response, and it really was a backlash against the success of the CTU. What do we say to the Michelle Rhees? What's the final thing that we should understand about what was affirmative and positive in the CTU taking command of the situation?
I think that one of the major things that came out of this is that it doesn't matter if you call yourself an education reformer. Education reform happens, true education reform, from the rank and file, from the people who are in the community, from the people who are in the streets, and from the people who work every day to see that children are taken care of, that they're given opportunity to learn, and that those people would take it upon themselves to walk out of work, to speak for themselves and make the point that outsiders can't keep using money to change education to a for-profit venture, that we're not going to let them do that to us, and that there's unity through strength. So money doesn't beat the true unity of rank and file and of the community.
Indeed, and we need to have both of you back and have more discussion on this. Too many important issues that we weren't even able to touch. But Brian Jones, thank you for all the work that you do. And Kimberly Bosky, yay, go CTU. We'll keep a close eye on it. We'll learn a lot of lessons from it. And we'll have broader discussions about what are some of the limits and what do we need to do to back up collective bargaining for our teachers.
But a real victory, something we haven't had in a long time. Congratulations again.
To both
of
you.
Thank you, and keep up the fight.
La lutta continua, indeed. Thank you both, Kim Lee Bosky and Brian Jones.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your Community and Labor Report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash, and log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.